Dad. Thank you so much for everything. Happy 70th.
Great.
1 minute.
Dad in his sleep.
Wasn't supposed to happen like this. I'm here for you.
This is my brother, Ben. Ben, this is Aaron.
You think anyone will understand you like I do?
What's this all about, man? Just trying to understand.
Sorry, Ben. I was gonna tell you.
When you lie,
you lie about us for.
There's a reason why people come together when someone dies.
People have to know what he was really like.
Why? He's dead. It's over.
Do it again like him.
Share this with anyone else. We have each other.
Gracias por acompañarnos en la sexta edición de Cine UFM Live. Voy a presentar a Laura y luego pues ya la voy a invitar al escenario virtual y ella que venga pues a compartir un poquito de sus experiencias, de sus procesos y también de sus proyectos. El proyecto que acaban de ver en el tráiler es la película Inheritance, que fue estrenada en el 2017 en el Festival South by Southwest de Austin. La película luego tuvo su debut y su recorrido en cines en Estados Unidos. Vamos a hablar un poquito de eso también. Y es una película que, curiosamente, pues fue grabada en Centroamérica, fue grabada principalmente en Belice. Entonces, también es interesante ver la perspectiva de una cineasta extranjera que viene a nuestra región y a crear pues proyectos que tienen este impacto en Centroamérica y que luego se van al mundo entero. Laura, welcome to the stage. It's great having you here. Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. Excited for having this conversation. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to begin our conversation by asking you, what was your initial drive to become a filmmaker?
I guess I wanted to change the world. Uh-huh. But I knew that I didn't feel that I was well suited for politics directly. I didn't think I had the personality or the stamina, and I really wanted to work with emotional truth and with creating culture that shaped culture. And I thought that movies were magical. And so when, you know, honestly, growing up in Louisiana, it didn't seem, and I know a lot of students in Guatemala might relate to this, but it didn't seem possible to work in the film industry because it felt so far away and like something that other people did. But at some point it occurred to me that it was also a job and that mm-hmm. you could just, especially when the equipment became more accessible and you could make projects on your own, I just couldn't imagine not trying. So it seemed like a way to help raise questions and create beauty and have people think about the world in new ways. And I really wanted to do it through emotions and through stories that really hopefully affected the heart.
Yeah. And now that you are on the other side, I mean, in the sense that you are working, you're having projects and you've had projects with a lot of recognition. How do you think that first step influenced in the development of your career?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've noticed this for people who are far more successful than I am and people who are, you know, still doing their first projects that in a way, no one ever really feels like they've made it. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how much you've done, you always think you have a drive to do more. And so I think it's interesting at some point to just embrace that and to really use that to question what are the stories I want to make and how do I want to tell them? And in that sense, it makes it that this idea that there's one point where you've broken in or where you haven't, I think you realize at some point that that's illusory.
Yeah. And speaking about the stories per se, and you say you wanted to change the world, and
I mean, it's true, and I was making fun of myself.
But I mean, that alludes to the fact that there was a lot of passion behind your drive to pursue this career path. But I know that in screenwriting, I'm not a screenwriter myself, but I know from other people's perspectives that it's part art and part craft. Like, there's a science to it, but there's also this artistic component to the screenwriter. So in your opinion and your experience, how much of it is art and how much of it is craft?
It's a really, really good question. And I think it's one that's hard to really get a grasp on when you're starting. I think it's helpful to use metaphors. Some people talk about a screenplay as like an architecture. You have a blueprint for the house, but it's not the house. Mm-hmm. A lot of people use that metaphor for screenwriting, which is really effective in a lot of ways, because screenwriting is a lot of design, but it's also not a complete metaphor, because you also need the actual words will be used, right? You're not just drawing the words, you're using words that will most likely make the final film. So there is an aspect of poetry. So I don't know if I could say that it's 50%. I don't know that I can put a number on it, but I think actually what's interesting is the tension between these two, right? Mm-hmm. Because within the science, there is great creativity. And you could say that some of our best scientists are artists on some level. And also some of my favorite artists are really rigorous about science and their process. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like craft, it's almost like the dancer, right, who goes to you have to perfect this language of that you know, if you're practicing certain turns for decades to be able to do them so that you can kind of seamlessly bring the emotion so that it comes to life. That's sort mm-hmm. of how I see it. It's like the discipline and the design and sort of the left brain aspects really need to merge with that sense of the wonder and the poetry and something that you can't turn into a cookie cutter program.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question for you in a way that's clear? Or?
Definitely. And it leads very well into my following question. And something that I am personally very, very interested is understanding the habits and the different processes that people develop, you know, to deal with this tension between the art and the science. I'm a huge fan of someone, for example, Tim Ferriss, who deconstructs mm-hmm. the habits of world-class performers. And I would like to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your personal process. What does it look like, and how have you developed it, and how do you refine it as you move forward with new projects?
Yeah, you know, this is another great question, also because I'm starting to write a new script and you're reminding me that I need to go back to this ritual very mm-hmm. intensively. And I also want to, before I describe mine, I want to just say to everyone, there's really no one way. The way that I describe is the way that works for me. And I'm like someone who is at my best in the morning. So mm-hmm. I really prioritize that as sort of a sacred writing time. And I'll walk you through that. But some people really come alive at night when the world shuts down, and that might be when it works for you. Or some people grab 5 minutes here and 5 minutes here. It's really good to be attuned to what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, you know, or your less than strengths.
Yeah.
So that you can really capitalize on your strong suits and support yourself where you need that support. So one thing for me, two things. The morning is my time. And also, I get a lot of ideas, which means that I can be pulled in this direction or that direction or this direction. And so I have to create enough structure that I can sort of relax into the process and know that the five other things I'm thinking about, I can like safely note them and they'll be here, but I can stay on the script or the story or the development. So it depends on what stage I'm at for the screenwriting process, right? Because once I'm actually writing the script, I have a lot of passion and momentum, and it usually just flows very naturally. But in the early stages, when you're really figuring out the characters, what their conflicts are, what their needs and their wants and what they need to overcome, it's a lot of heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. And so I basically, every morning, I have a ritual. I wake, I meditate, and maybe do a little yoga. I have tea, and then I sit at the computer. Mm-hmm. I try not to look at email. I mean, right now that's I'm a little bit reading a lot of news, as I'm sure many people are. But, you know, it's sort of once I read email, and news, my brain is moving in those directions. And I know with the way that, that your residual, even when you can have numerous windows open on your screen, your attention can linger with these other kind of open-ended. So it's like you almost want to create like a very safe play space for you to go and go deep. And then you don't want to stay too long. You always want to leave when you know you have enough sort of story momentum that when you start the next day. And when I'm in the really difficult phases, I might only work for 3 or 4 hours on that project. And then I'm doing business emails or other activities that you can jump around. But that morning time is the really special time.
Mm-hmm. And do you have like specific research practices that you like to do when you're developing a script or when you want to add like extra layers of complexity to the story? Is that part of your process?
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of my process. I'm an obsessive researcher. Uh-huh. So that's a part of my process, but it can get out of hand. So what I find is that I have to be really focused in my research. Otherwise, I mean, even today, I was looking up the name of this college that I need to name. Mm-hmm. And I started reading about Native American symbols because it related to how I thought they would name this college. And I was like, no, I've got to pull back because this is going to go too far. And I think that's the other thing. Like when I was first in school, there was no internet. Mm-hmm. And I think for students who've grown up with the internet always being there, they might be used to it, but it's like a permanent distraction. And I really think screenwriting is so challenging that a lot is really thinking, what are the systems? And a lot of screenwriters I know will turn off their internet for certain amounts of time because, yeah, you want to research or even researching names. Like names can take you a week and you might change mm-hmm. them later. So you have to really kind of figure out, what's the right use of my time to go as deep as possible in the story, and where should I put the brakes?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that is super useful. And we have a few questions from the audience that I think relate specifically to the topic that we're talking about. But we also have some shout outs. So Sophie Ramirez says, "Hi, Laura," and a couple of hearts. Lisa Resina says, "Hi, Laura."
There's a dog here, everyone. Oh, hi, everyone. It makes me so happy. Oh.
So here we go.
We
have a few comments. Por favor, si tienen más comentarios, más preguntas, aquí estamos felices. Javi Parellada says, "Hola, Laura." también Alejandro Utrera agradece pues, que preparen y presentemos más actividades. Gracias. Alejandro, es un gusto poder compartir esto con ustedes. And we have a question from Hans Calderon, and he says, "Hi, Laura. As a writer, how does it work? I mean, you write what you want and sell your script, or there's a line that someone asks you to write. Do they give you the general idea, and then you write it adding your creativity?"
Yeah, it's good. Well, it depends. So when you write a script on speculation, it means that usually you're pursuing your own idea. You may have optioned a story, which means you have the rights to another property, whether it's a book, a short story, or just an idea, or it's an original idea. But if you write it on spec, you usually write the entire script on your own, and then you try to sell it. Mm-hmm. In other cases, you might partner with a studio or production company to develop an idea, whether it's a pilot or a feature. In that case, you would be commissioned to write a treatment, which is a several page document in prose form outlining what it is. Or you might be commissioned to write the first or two drafts of the script. You know, it's with the Writers Guild in the U.S., it's pretty regulated how those steps go. Mm-hmm. But, it sort of depends on the project and if you are bringing it to someone or if someone is bringing it to you.
Yeah. And following up with that response, I wanted to ask you what makes you embark in the adventure of writing a new script? Like, how do you decide this is a project that I really want to take on versus a project that you say, maybe this is not for me or maybe this is not for the, maybe this is not the right time to take on this project?
Do you mean if this is someone else's project or if this in terms of like even my own idea?
Even your own ideas, like how do you make the decision to take on a new project and go full on with it?
I'm going to again compliment your question because they're all really smart.
But Thank you.
A Well, also, it's a really good question because, to be honest, it's one I'm asking myself again recently. Because I think earlier in the beginning, I would have an idea and I would really just hold on to it and pursue it relentlessly. I once had a script that I wrote for way too long. And at some point, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to figure this out. And I moved on. And the next script I wrote came together so quickly I sort of could take all the lessons I'd learned from that script and apply it to the next one. And the first script, the idea was a little too sophisticated for where I was at the time. And this was years ago. But now I've noticed that I'm someone who gets a lot of ideas, but that doesn't mean all ideas are worth pursuing.
Yeah.
So what I do now is I either talk to my manager or I talk to friends or other writers or just anyone who watches film or television and just describe them your idea and see their reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that you write to please other people, because I think ultimately if you're not passionate about it, it will lack that vibrancy. But it will tell you, is there the spark of the idea that might speak to other people? And again, you might have a project you're so passionate about, you don't even ask this question. If so, just you run with it full force. But you can also, writing is so hard and it can take so long that I like to now really think about it. But again, yeah. I'm someone who gets a lot of ideas, and that means most of them aren't good.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have a filter. You know what I mean? That's the thing. Some people have fewer ideas and they're all gold. But they get more frustrated waiting for the ideas. I might have a lot of ideas, but I really need to say, is this worth it? Because I might dedicate a year of my life to it.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think, and this is something I've experienced myself, and I'm trying to execute more. So it's the ability of saying no and being more intentional with what you embark, because you only have so many scripts that you're going to write in your life. I only have so many songs that I'm going to write. So as time passes by, I need to choose wisely. Otherwise, as you say, a script might take years, an album might take months or years as well. And I think this is something that would be beneficial if you learn it earlier rather than later in your career.
I agree. Although, I'm not sure if someone had told me this, I would have really taken the lesson in.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say, guys, Fernando and I are saying, really think about the ideas you say yes to.
Yeah.
But I mean, how much of creativity is really listening to some inner voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you have to create silence or make space,
mm-hmm.
right? Because otherwise, if you're just working out of fear or anxiety, you might, okay, this idea, I'm going to pursue this, but you don't know why. And it might not be something that resonates you with on a really deep level. But if you can really stop and ask the question, and then you might even say, I think this idea is right. Let me work on it for 2 weeks rather than 6 months. Right.
Yeah.
Let me pursue it for 2 weeks and I'm going to, you know, maybe make a note on my calendar. Does this feel like the project I should be pursuing now?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's where other people that you trust really help. Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know for songwriting because I think that depends. You might be collaborating with other people or you might really be crafting it on your own. But I find that there's definitely a group of people that I might call up and say, okay, these are the three ideas I'm working on. Which one should I pursue? And I just kind of use them to sort of, you know, bounce ideas off them and see their reaction. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is super useful. And this is something that not only I think it's very important, and I do have my board of people I trust in different parts of the world, and I send them sketches and demos and ask for feedback. But this is also something that has come up in our previous events, having a close network of people that you trust and will give you honest feedback, not only praise, because I think sometimes as artists, you might feel a little self-conscious with what you're working. And I understand that. I felt that as well. But I think it's very important to have someone who will say things in a straight way and say, okay, yeah, but these are the weaknesses or the blind spots of your project, and highlight those areas for improvement, because perhaps it's something that you're not seeing and would really benefit your project. So I think this is like a constant, like having that a network of trusted mentors, if you like.
I think completely agree. And I would say trusted mentors, but also trusted peers. I mean, yeah. I think that's a really powerful thing about film school. And I certainly saw that community being created with, among the students at U of M. And there are definitely times at this point where I will only, you know, because at some point you don't necessarily have the mentor, you know, mm-hmm. at your ready. And so, but you still need that kind of critical feedback, as you're saying. And yeah. if you have the trust built up, then you don't need them to praise your ego. Because you're mm-hmm. not saying, can I do this? You're saying, is this worth my time? Yeah. Or should I look into other projects? I think the other thing is, especially for film and television, is film and television, but certainly other art forms, but your project is always going to be building off the language of other film and television shows. So if you say this, they'll say, well, is it like this and this? And of course, you're not going to be repeating, but you need to make sure it's distinct. Uh-huh. And if what you're doing has already been done, if it's too nebulous, if it's not defined, or if it doesn't even fall into a genre where you can pitch it, you might have a hard time getting it made. Uh-huh. And again, it's not that you should conform to something, but you know, it does involve time and money and assembling a team to make a project, unless you were just an artist who's going to shoot it on your own with a video camera, which I'm not. I want to have a team and I want to be able to raise money. That means you have to be able to clearly convey that idea even on a story level. And while hopefully you don't want to make your project just so it could be marketed, you want it to be clearly conveyed.
And how do you manage, how do you strike a balance between something that is a reflection of your own artistic pursuits, but also something that will have an audience and will have enough interest so other people will say, yeah, I put money behind this and let's make it happen.
Well, if I had figured out that secret, I would have made a lot more work by now. But no, the truth is that I feel now, I feel more equipped to do it now than I was before. Mm-hmm. But I would again say, you know, again, we're saying like the advice we wish we had in the beginning.
Yeah.
One advice for me is really, if I'm really able to listen to that internal creative voice and I'm really being truthful with myself, then I have a good sense for what I want to see on a really pure level, right? And on that sense, it's usually quite universal that other people, it's going to speak to other people too. But you have to really be listening and really know what it is you're trying to say mm-hmm. or ask.
And is that something, for example, you were saying that you want to make sure that it's something that will resonate with other people. Is that something that you take into consideration in the development stages of a project, or is it something that you ask yourself as the project moves forward?
I'm not sure. Because mm-hmm. I think mainly it's as the project moves forward. Like in the very beginning of an idea, you know, it's sort of like a seed that you put in the ground and you water it may not come up. So I don't ask too many questions. Then I just keep a file where I just jot, you know, when I said I get a lot of ideas, which means they're not going to all be good. I keep a file with just ideas. And I've had this file for years. And sometimes when I'm like, what do I want to work on now? If I don't have something that I've already jumped into, I'll go back to the file. And sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, that was a good idea. I didn't have time to pursue it. Or, oh, that's a good idea, but I'm no longer passionate about pursuing it. Mm-hmm. So I think that the idea has to be at a certain stage for it to be worth it to kind of test. But I mean, I think in some ways, if I'm really passionate about something, I feel confident it will speak. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably gets more true the older I get. I don't mm-hmm. know that that was always so true. But I think the more confident I am, the more I'm willing to test it out with others. And it, you know, even if it doesn't speak to someone, they might reflect it back to you and you think, okay, it might not be a show or a movie that they'd watch, but when they reflect it back to me, I know why it matters to me and I know, you know, to whom it might speak.
Yeah.
Because now, I mean, I think with all of us, we don't need to make a project that speaks to everyone everywhere because there's a lot of niche programming, right? Yeah. Culturally, geographically, different identity groups, different interests. But it needs to have a viable audience if it wants to enter the marketplace and not be a museum piece.
Yeah, and I think that is key, and that is something that we put a lot of emphasis on at the film school, that you need to have that artistic drive, but that also has to be paired with a strategic decision making, as you were saying, and I totally agree. One resource that I would like to share with the audience that I like very much is The Creative Independent. I don't know if you, follow. It's a website, and it's a great website for independent creators of, you know, artists, musicians, script writers. And something that I like is that it highlights different career paths and different models that work. So you have a wider frame of references, not only the, because I think we tend, and especially in a place like Guatemala, we tend to see to the big studios and say, okay, that's the goal. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing,
yeah.
But there are a lot of different models that work and are more accessible in a way. So I think, as you were saying, it's very important to identify those niche audiences or niche markets and have a way to address them. So yeah, the Creative Independent, if you haven't seen it, I strongly suggest it to you and to everyone that's watching. And
just one thing I would add to that is kind of in terms of like the way you pursue ideas, bouncing off peers and mentors is really smart. And also it's just really good to know how you work. I tend to think of writing as a solitary activity because I, except for one script, write alone. And I like to write alone, but now that I'm working on I'm developing a television show and, you know, there's a production company, there's a supervising showrunner, there are more people. And I find it to be very useful, the phases where you're workshopping ideas as a group, and then you go and do some deep processing alone, or maybe I write a draft of the pitch alone. Mm-hmm. But I think for some people, you know, there's a lot of writing teams in Hollywood for a reason, is that for some people, screenwriting, they need to work in pairs or in a small group. And I think it's good to know, again, what are your strengths and where do you need support? Mm-hmm. You know, are you going to go crazy working with someone else, or are you going to go crazy in your room, you know, banging your forehead against the wall?
Mm-hmm. And I would like to ask you. You just mentioned that you have been working for a script for television, and I know you have worked on both on television and on film. So just ask you a little bit about the differences between the two formats and how your work needs to adapt if you're going to do a script for television or a script for a feature.
I mean, I think on a very kind of basic level, for a feature film is a complete statement because it ends. And on a series, and I have only written dramas so far, but that means they're hour long. You need a lot of world building and you need something that's going to propel the story forward as an open question. So mm-hmm. I think on a very simple level, they're very different structurally, but you might do a similar deep dive on the character's backstory. You really need to, everything that I wanted was very character driven. So I need to like really be clear on the character's wants, needs, obstacles, and backstories. But structurally, I mean, a series, you know, you sort of need to end on a driving question that makes you want to watch again. And the feature, you have to really do the deep dive of like, once you get to the climax determines the meaning, and then the meaning is going to close even if you have an ambiguous ending.
Yeah.
And so they're just, there's a different burden on an ending in a feature that you don't have, but there's a different burden on world building and the propulsive narrative for a series.
Mm-hmm. And what about the different roles involved? You mentioned, for example, the showrunner, and you mentioned that in television it's more collaborative, in filmmaking is more of a lonely journey. But what are the specific roles that interact in each of the two formats?
Yeah, maybe I would just specify, I think for filmmaking, it depends on what budget level you're at, how lonely it is. Mm-hmm. I think the higher you go up in the Hollywood studio system, for example, you might wish it were a little lonelier than it is. You might be getting notes from everyone.
Yeah.
But at the same time, then you're going to be playing with a larger budget, which has a capacity to, you know, reach more people. I think I would start with a different role of the screenwriter in both instances. Mm-hmm. Especially since this is on screenwriting,
yeah.
You know, in film, we tend to think of the director as king or queen,
yeah.
But you know, the director is at the top, but in TV, it's really the writer. And the reason it's the writer is because the person who writes the pilot is the creator of the show. The creator of the show may or may not be also an executive producer. It sort of depends on their deal. But and the showrunner is the person who sort of oversees the team of writers who that make up the writer's room. Mm-hmm. And the writer's room is a job is to break down the story. But again, it's all seen by the showrunner and creator, who may be the same person or not.
Yeah.
And they also have to get notes from the studio or the network to make sure that on every episode. So it's a lot of management as well. Mm-hmm. So that's in terms of the screenwriting part, but it's also as a writer in television, you, as you move up the ladder, you start to get a different like producing credit. And mm-hmm. so you might see like, why is that writer having a producer? That's just sort of the way, and it's what it does is affect your pay, but it also reflects your seniority and your deal. So it's a way to entice a certain writer onto one show versus another, because they might get a fee per episode, even if they're not writing that episode.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
I mean, I'm focused on the writing part, but does that answer the question?
Yeah, definitely. And I think I've also heard what you say, that in television, the writer is king or queen. And it's interesting how the worlds are so different, especially because, I mean, in Guatemala, we don't have a strong television industry, but I think the opportunities are there to explore them. And it's also very useful for our audience, I think, to understand the differences and the nuances between the two formats. We have a few questions from the audience that relate to what we've been talking about. We have one from Fabricio Diaz.
Hola.
I'm going to read it in Spanish, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
And it relates to television. It says, ¿Cómo crear un mundo lo suficientemente grande para una serie?
It's a great pregunta. how to make a world that's sufficiently big for a series? It's a really good question, because I've never thought of it in that way. I think what I would do first is look at shows that you love. Think about, you could look at a show with a world as big as Game of Thrones, for example, or a world as small as, Mrs. Fletcher, or like with something else that's a small world, you know, something that's more of a domestic drama. I think first know the world of your show, and then it will tell you how big that world needs to be. Mm-hmm. And then in Game of Thrones, you need to create the whole mythology, because if you don't have this mythology, then you have nowhere to go. It's all in television. It's all, where are you going to go from here?
Yeah.
And that would be your reason to make your world really big. And in terms of a more domestic show, you need to know that there's something, again, that's hooking you. That's a through line.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, why do people keep watching? And often we keep watching because we love characters, but we love characters who are trying to overcome certain problems. It's the problem, really, that like, I want to see them do X. I want to see them overcome Y, or how are they going to resolve? But in terms of how big the world, it's sort of, I guess it's like, do you have all of the structure to sustain your world? And so it's really relative to your story concept.
Mm-hmm.
Fabrizio, did I answer that question suficiente grande for your needs?
We have another follow-up question from Fabricio.
I see.
And he says, ¿se puede desarrollar una serie en solitario sin reunirse con todos los escritores como en las grandes series?
It does happen. It's newer, but sometimes there are series that only one writer has written. I believe, I don't know if you guys are familiar with a show called Devs. It's on Hulu. It's the guy who he directed them all, and I believe he's the sole writer, but we can check after.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, in this case, like he did Ex Machina, the feature film that you might be familiar with. So I'm assuming, is Hulu available in Guatemala?
I don't think so.
Okay, so I'm making a reference that's totally not fair. I'll just give it in theory, and I'm sure we can look at other examples, but... in that case, it's rare, but he wrote every episode and directed them. I don't know of another instance of it, but in that case, you could look at it almost as a feature film that is using the series format and chopping it up into hour-long episodes that will take, you know, 8 or 9 hours that you can stream. Mm-hmm. It's not that common. And I think the reason it's not that common is a little bit like your other question, Fabrizio, because it's the world and the story world gets so big that it's a lot to have in your mind. Mm-hmm. And you'll see often in writers' rooms, there will be entire walls where you track a character. They're like, oh, no, but in episode 3, they do this. So in here, they can't have another fight with their dad, you know, yeah. And it's like literally cards. And it's like the whole room will be taken over with these notes because it's just so much to hold. It's a little too much for most of us. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we'll be seeing more exceptions going forward, especially as things change with the pandemic. Because right now, a lot of writers' room are happening on, you know, like us now, I mean, or, you know, well, more interactively in that all the writers are in a video chat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different room than people sit, you know, having eye contact and understanding the dynamics of when you speak and don't speak and who's listening and who's speaking. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you mentioned the current situation, because one of my questions was, what impact do you foresee COVID-19 having on the industry, both film and television?
I want to say that if I could predict that, I would be making money and making projects that we could all work on immediately.
Yeah.
I want to say first, I don't know, but I also I don't think anyone knows. Yeah. I think there's a lot of speculation. I think that people want to have an answer because it feels like certainty, and certainty is really reassuring. I think that what we really need to embrace is to be in a place of not knowing and to look at, you know, as we were speaking about earlier, like to finding creative ways to use this moment where we both don't go crazy and we can build community and feel connected. And also we're being realistic about what's safe and not safe in terms of set, because set has been traditionally a place where, you know, a cold will, you know, catch a simple cold, everyone will get it. So people are talking about having very rigorous testing before we open up sets. I know a friend of mine who's a very high level editor in Hollywood that, you know, he's been working from home, which previously they wouldn't have felt safe having that material anywhere but the studio. Yeah. So they've been allowing more people to work at home. And I think that trend will continue. And now they're about to go in and do the sound mix, and what they're doing in this like huge Hollywood sound studio, they're all going to have a separate part block literally mapped out where they will be. So, you know, they'll go in with their snacks and their hand sanitizer as if they're in their own like compartment. And, you know, again, it's a huge studio. So they would probably have a lot more people. And now it will be only who's essential. And mm-hmm. I think that there will be a lot of opportunity for really pared down crews, which means that people who've come up with tiny crews have a lot of valuable experience. Mm-hmm. Because these are people who know how to shoot something with 5 people or, you know, 10 people versus always 25, 50, 300.
Yeah.
But it means that we need stories that can support that too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I guess the format of the stories are going to change a lot. A few weeks, I think last week, Javi was telling us about a short that was made during the pandemic, and it's 2 people like shooting from their bedrooms, and that's the footage they use. So I guess the format is going to change, and the types of stories also are going to evolve. But I feel, without being insensitive to the challenges of the current situation, that there is a lot of opportunity for innovation and for rethinking about the way we approach our different crafts.
I agree, and the thing is, you know, that's the thing. Problems are always opportunities for innovation. And it doesn't mean that there's not like a confusing or challenging transition as we get there. Mm-hmm. But essentially that's where most innovation happens, is when we're really up against a wall. Yeah. And, you know, so it doesn't mean, again, let's not pretend that this is easy for everyone, especially for people who are sick or losing loved ones, but, or even people suffering from depression and loneliness, you know, from the lack of interaction. But okay, you know, factoring that in, what are the positive choices we're going to make, and how do we find ways to connect or even improve on some systems?
Mm-hmm.
I also would add that I spoke to a commercial cinematographer last week as a part of a different group I'm in. And he was, you know, he's traveled all over the world shooting commercials, and he was about to be the cinematographer. So let's say the director of photography for people shooting in their homes in India, in Colombia, like all over the world. And he's in Los Angeles. And he was like, it feels crazy. And I'm like, well, actually, your title is director of photography, and what you're doing is directing.
Yeah.
You know, so he basically, each person that was in this commercial had to have one person in their home who could shoot them. And he's directing that person and setting up the lighting, but doing everything via verbal instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think for commercials, like, we're going to have to find a way. But I think commercials, because they're also so directly market driven, they'll find a way right away, because they're not going to mm-hmm. miss out on a chance to update it. But I think for, you know, series and features, it's longer. And, you know, I mean, I don't know that I want someone's uncle filming the character of a story, right? You know, maybe their uncle's an amazing photographer, or their aunt, but
yeah.
I feel like, you know, there's a lot of artistry that does come from the collaboration in person. And that's, yeah. I'm going to be curious, how do we have to innovate in terms of the way we interact, but also what's the medical technology we might be using? Do you know, are we going to check everyone's temperature every day on set? Because that, uh-huh. and what if that could work? You know, I mean, again, yeah. I'm not a doctor, and this isn't a medical talk, but.
No, I have seen photos of people in productions, and they are wearing these suits incredible. So I think yeah, I mean,
and yet I will find a way. They're saving those suits for people that need them in the hospital. Yeah. You know, let's get our priorities straight too.
Yeah, but as you say, yeah, people will find a way. We have a few questions from the audience, and I also wanted to ask a few quick questions also on inheritance, but I think I would like to take the audience's questions first, because I think they will relate to the film, and then we can move with the final stages of the talk. And just to say, like, time has flown by amazingly. We're on 54 minutes, and it feels like it's been 5. We have a question from Cristian Perdomo. This is in Spanish, and he says, ¿cuáles son algunas dificultades que puede enfrentar un guionista, sea para películas o para series, que está comenzando y no es muy conocido, aunque tal vez tenga un buen guión? ¿Y cómo superar estas dificultades? So I think, yeah.
Yeah. Great question. And one that I actually am personally familiar with. I know what it was like to have, if I'm, and Fernando, let me know if I'm understanding it right, but, mm-hmm. you know, what are the difficulties that you can encounter as a screenwriter for film or for series as you're beginning and you're not very well known?
Yeah.
Even though you might have a good script.
Yeah.
It's a really tough question. There isn't one answer. Let me give a handful, and then and hopefully this will be of some use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, congratulations on having a good script.
Mm-hmm.
I that's already a massive feat that you've already gotten through. So that's a big deal. And I would say, you know, first of all, make sure you have other people read the script and that you're getting that feedback, because I think we can all fall in love with our own writing. If you're not in love with your first draft, there's something wrong. At the same time, later when you read your first draft, I usually find that I would never show that to a person. But mm-hmm. it's, you know, if you've gotten to the place where you have a good script and you've gotten feedback, there are a handful of screenwriting competitions that can be great. And if your script gets recognition, I know a lot of people who have ended up with managers and agents from them, or found money to get those scripts made if they want to direct them. However, it is a bit like playing the lottery. So, you know, you could also, if you wrote a script about mountain climbing, and there are a lot of scripts about mountain climbing, they might think your script is great, but they might pick two others. And not, you know, mountain climbing was a random example, but you get the idea. There are scripts set in a hospital or a pandemic. They're not going to pick all scripts that fall into that demographic or that section. So it's not a great thing to count on, but there's a lot of ones that are really worth trying for. And we can put some links into list mm-hmm. of some of the better screenwriting competitions, because they are not, there's a ton of them and they're not all created equal. There are definitely some that are respected. And I say the industry, I really do mean more Hollywood, and that doesn't have to be a priority because I suspect, there's so many different amazing film industries in different parts of Latin America that I think it's good to focus on those as well. But I'm just going to speak from my own experience. And then I would also say having a network. And having a network, in the past meant going to places and asking questions, or going to, a Q&A and talking to people after, or connecting with other people, volunteering our films. That's going to be changing with the pandemic too. But I think certainly at UFM, that's already a network that you have extending from there. And it's good to reach out to anyone who could be of support. But don't reach out, don't ask too much, because people will usually offer support if they have it. And then I think having a mentor can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. I wish that had been my path earlier on. Go back and rewrite our own story.
I think we've done a lot of reminiscing and wishful advice.
I know, it's funny. We're saying this as if, we're, really at the last projects forever. I think you have a lot of songs and art ahead of you, Fernando.
I hope so. Yeah, we have a few more. We have one from Juan Pablo, and he says, "Hello, do you think some projects that are good and should be kept to be offered for sale in a precise moment?" So I think this is about timing. What is the right timing for a project, you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. It matters. Oh, sorry, I'm seeing Juan Pablo's hilarious picture too. It's hilarious and alarming. I personally don't obsess over the timing, because I find that I like to work on the things that I can control.
Okay.
I think that's where working with, again, once you advance and you have a manager and agent, that's their job to really think about it. You might have some opinions, but I personally don't obsess about it, because I think, you may, for example, I might go for a meeting on a script that someone loves, but it's not for them. And then we have a conversation about a topic. And then 3 years later, I'm writing it and I could follow up with someone. Timing unfolds in the way that it unfolds. And I personally try not to be too calculated. But it also may be that I think that some people have better business strategy around the timing. But mm-hmm. it's usually the people who are writing the checks. So I'm not the person writing the checks.
mm-hmm.
Did I dodge that question, or did I...
No, I think you replied it. You replied it very well. And we have one more question from the audience, and then I'm going to ask if we can have like 5 more minutes, because if it's okay with you to cover a few more topics, and then we'll be finishing. But Alejandro is asking, why most series have no more than 4 seasons? Besides money, in what depends the number of seasons?
Yes. There are many answers to this question. I mean, I think some series don't need more than 4 seasons, which uh-huh. we've seen. But sometimes we love the characters and we want them to keep going, or they haven't. Usually it depends on the network. If it's network or if it's a streamer. Like, for example, Netflix, they base it on new subscribers. So if a series, even if it's doing really well, if they don't get new subscribers when the next season launches, they may not plan to do another season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for other things, they're looking at their ratings and the popularity. If they're doing well, then someone's willing to put the money behind it. But it tends to be a bit driven by numbers in that sense. Or numbers and or there have to be a really big champion. Like if there's someone, an executive that's like, no, I really believe in this. Or if it's something that's not that expensive. For example, I don't know if all of you have seen The Wire on HBO.
But Yeah,
it's an incredible series. It doesn't start off so strong, but it's an incredible series that a lot of us think is like some of the best TV ever made. But part of it is like it went under the radar a long time because it didn't have huge stars. Now Idris Elba is one of the people who, mm-hmm. Is like huge. But there were a lot of people in it that were not known, and it wasn't that expensive to make. So HBO's like, sure, you know, we like to do prestige projects that are rigorous, so we will keep putting money towards this. And HBO is a little bit more, they'll do more prestige works, whereas like someone like ABC, NBC, it's going to be, are we getting eyes on the screen? Because that's what generates our commercials, which is what means that we stay afloat.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking about networks and about the distribution aspects of a project, I would just like to ask you two questions regarding Inheritance. And the first one is, what did it mean to you to have South by Southwest be the place where Inheritance was premiered? Because I know you went to UT, so you, and South by Southwest is like this huge event in Austin. So what did it mean to you personally, but also for the film?
Yeah, it's true. And I know that you know and are familiar with South by Southwest too. And a lot of people listening have had the experience of it. It's, you know, it's such a special festival because it really is about like the love of storytelling, filmmaking, independent film and music and ideas, right? That they really fuse all these things together. And I think Austin has just such an intense openness and that it doesn't have this sort of snobbier, kind of more closed off elitist feeling that maybe other festivals can have, which have their own benefit. Because I think in some ways, South by Southwest isn't known as being a buyer's, even though it's very respected, it's not known as being a buyer's festival. We were fortunate to get distribution coming out of it, but there usually aren't what they call, you know, there usually aren't wars, bidding wars for a film. That might be changing because it is one of the top festivals still and people love it. But it's sort of, I mean, I think I was aware of that going into it, but you're right, because I had gone to UT and because I have family in Austin. And in a way, because it was also like easier to get some of our cast from Belize to come. And that meant a lot to me. So we were able to have people, you know, really there. And it feels so special for your premiere. You want to have, you know, everyone saluted because it's so much work to make movies. And it's nice to actually, you know, and a lot of it is solitary and isolating and it takes so long. You want to get together and have a real celebration.
Yeah. And how did the distribution work from there on? You say that you got distribution right after the festival. How did that work? Were you involved in the process or is it something that someone else manages?
I was definitely involved. It was something that took, you know, our team of executive producers and producers and, you know, my collaborator who worked with me on it. We really all got together and it felt pretty clear to us that this was the best deal. You know, again, with independent film, it's sort of, you don't know, you're taking a risk. Are they going to put publicity behind it? We wanted a theatrical. We had a theatrical. It was a very small one, but it was special to see it on the screen, you know, and to walk by the marquee and to see your film's title and to go in and you know, see people pay for tickets. But also, you know, I would say a lot more people have seen it on Amazon. You know, it's a really challenging film, so it isn't one that's for everyone. I think, you know, part of the distribution deal we had was it was tied in with the Amazon. We knew we'd be streaming on Amazon. And Amazon really sought out films that South by. And so that kind of helped the distribution process.
Excellent. Thank you. I think we are running low on time. So first of all, I would like to thank you for, I mean, sharing your experiences with us and your advice. This has been a really enjoyable discussion for me and I hope for all of our audiences. And I'd just like to ask you if there's anything that you would like to add beyond the questions, any word of advice, any book that you think screenwriters should read or anything that you'd just like to share with everyone watching.
Wow, that's like the biggest question. I think I I think I would just say that screenwriting is, it's really psychologically challenging. Mm-hmm. And it takes, for most of us, a lot of discipline. And so it does help to have some kind of daily ritual. And I would say for a lot of people, it helps to, you know, consider a meditation practice or something that helps you really get into that open state of mind. And then to just study scripts and movies that you love. Like, what are the projects that light you up? Like, break them down and really see how those scripts are functioning and see where's the art versus the science. Mm-hmm. And it'll really infuse whatever you do next, because we're always building off the language of what's come before us.
Yeah,
and that will give you a lot of confidence. And I think the confidence can help you and then also help you push your ideas as far as they can be and really just think, who are you as a person? What kind of world do you want to build? Mm-hmm. And make sure your stories are reflecting that.